Welcome to the Times of Israel's daily briefing. Today is Saturday, April 6th, day 183 to the war with Hamas. Amanda Borchel, Dan here with our U.S. Bureau Chief Jacob Magid from New York. Hi, Jacob. Thanks for joining me. Shabbat Shalom. And did you feel the earthquake yesterday?
Yeah, I'm a little shaken up, I must say. Thanks for having me, though, Amanda. Shabbat Shalom.
Pleasure. Glad you're safe. We'll hear what steps were actually taken following the tense phone call between U.S. President Joe Biden and Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu in light of Monday's accidental strike on an aid convoy. We'll also hear updates on how Israel views the lack of progress towards a hostage release deal and how Qatar is responding to Israel's insinuations. And we'll hear about a new bid for statehood by the Palestinian Authority at the United Nations. All this and much, much more when we're back.
The Technion Israel Institute of Technology is where some of Israel's brightest minds ask the biggest question of all. What if? What if they could take on the world's biggest challenges? What if they could develop life-changing environmental, scientific, health, medical, and technological discoveries that will make a huge impact on Israel and the planet? But they don't just ask the question, they answer it too. They turn those ideas into reality. They make them happen. To see just some of the incredible things they've achieved, get the Technion Booklet of Wonders at ats.org/wonders. We hope it inspires you to give them your support so they can keep doing what they do best. The American Technion Society. World-changing discoveries by Israel's brightest minds, made possible by you.
First, some headlines. Israel is in mourning following the announcement of the death of hostage Elad Katsir, whom the IDF believes was murdered by his captors in mid-January, not long after the Palestinian Islamic Jihad published a second video showing him in captivity. Katsir's body was recovered last night in an IDF operation after it was buried in the Khan Yunis refugee camp in southern Gaza. Information on the grave was obtained about a week ago, with final confirmation on the location being received last night, and within a few hours, troops of the Maglan and Egoz commando units reached the site, exhumed the body, and brought it back to Israel for identification. Katsir's mother, Hana, was also kidnapped from her home on Kibbutz Nir Oz on October 7th. She was released on November 24th as part of a temporary ceasefire deal, and his father, Rami Katsir, was murdered during the massacre on October 7th. Rocket alert sirens have sounded in northern communities near the border with Lebanon numerous times today after the IDF announced that it had carried out airstrikes on Hezbollah positions in southern Lebanon. Troops of the Givati Brigade operating in the Khan Yunis region in southern Gaza Strip located and destroyed a weapons depot, the IDF says. United States President Joe Biden said Friday that Israel was heeding his demands to let aid into Gaza a day after he warned Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu of a sharp shift in policy. So, Jacob, you're here to tell us, first of all, what steps has Israel actually taken so far that we've seen on the ground?
So far, what we've seen on the ground is nothing yet. The closest thing I can say to a step would be the 100 trucks, a convoy that left from Allenby and is making its way, Allenby, the Jordan West Bank crossing, and is making its way toward Kerem Shalom into Gaza. But those 100 trucks have not yet entered, but that would be a massive boost in the amount of trucks that typically come from Jordan, which is what a lot of these countries like the U.S. and the U.N. have been asking for. It was interesting moments before we started recording is that the U.N.'s humanitarian coordinator said that Israel had agreed to start letting in up to 50 trucks a day from Jordan each day. So I guess 100 is way more than that. I think this is more of a one-time thing, but we should be seeing a regular flow of aid from Jordan. And then the bigger steps are getting areas open in the northern Gaza and also Ashdod, which almost in a lot of ways could make this whole pier that we're working on kind of obsolete. There's a temporary idea to have Ashdod open, the port that Israel has, have aid go straight through there. And then once the pier is up in Gaza, maybe to have that be replaced with this temporary pier in Gaza. But in terms of efficiency, given that Ashdod is this massive port and already been working, it's probably more efficient. But in the long run, I think people are seeing that this temporary pier will be better to have in terms of growing Gaza's economy, and having its own pier is important as well. So again, what the U.S. said after these announcements were made is that we're happy about them, we welcome them, but where the proof is in the pudding, we want to see the actual actions in terms of how they're implemented.
I'd been under the impression that the Ashdod port had already been used, especially for some massive flour shipment that had already been delivered. So what is new here? And wouldn't all the material have to go through one of the crossings anyway? It's not like it goes from Ashdod by sea into Gaza. It still has this whole check the truck bottleneck, right?
Correct. That's very much true. The idea with, first of all, Ashdod has been used for flour shipments, but that's just about it. Israel made these one-time kind of exceptions for the U.S. and Turkey to send large shipments of flour through the sea. And still, the goal, though, having Ashdod is just that you can have maritime aid come in from Cyprus instead of having it dock in Gaza and be checked in Cyprus. It's going to be docked in Ashdod, checked in Kerem Shalom or Ashdod, and then moved into Gaza. Anything you do is going to require trucks at some point, either on the border of Gaza or getting to the border and then into Gaza. But still, the idea is to just flood Gaza with as much aid as possible, and every route you can do is will help. And I think ARES and right now is incredibly important. The question though becomes, and we've talked about this, is who's going to really secure the convoys in northern Gaza? Israel doesn't really want to be the one actually distributing the aid. There's trying to get more PA involvement, Palestinian Authority involvement, in securing and distributing the aid. That's something that I think would help lead to a greater PA role in Gaza, which Israel is very gingerly up supporting for now, but only in very small doses. But it's probably going to be something that's going to be needed there. In order to get to make opening ARES crossing an effective move.
We are recording on Shabbat on Saturday, and the crossings are, as far as we know, closed today. Is there no huge public outcry against this as well?
I mean, I've spoken to several officials in the UN agencies that talk about it a lot, about their frustration. We do note that the UN's humanitarian coordinator, Jamie McGoldrick, who one of those officials I spoke with, and was totally blown away by the fact that this is still closed on Shabbat when we need every day that counts. He said that Israel's agreed to expand the hours. We don't know yet exactly how often and how much, but it sounds like that could probably eat into Friday or Saturday in terms of operational expansion.
Jacob, we've filled many podcasts speaking about the tense ties between the U.S. and Israel, but United States Ambassador to Israel Jack Lew pushed back against the idea that relations between the White House and Israel were fraying, and actually dismissed accusations that Biden was trying to unseat Netanyahu in an interview that was published yesterday in the Israeli daily Yediot Ahronot. So, what else did he say?
I thought the most interesting thing he said was that he was pressed repeatedly. This is one of his first interviews he's given since becoming ambassador in October. He's not the same kind of ambassador that we had before with Tom Nides, who was much more, had more of a public face and was known by the Israeli public and kind of a larger than life figure in a lot of ways. Not that Lew isn't former Treasury Secretary, former Obama Chief of Staff. He's got a pretty long resume himself, but he doesn't speak to the press very much. So this interview was really interesting, an eye into what he thinks. And the main thing I thought was interesting is that he said that the U.S. doesn't have an alternative to a hostage deal, which kind of makes sense given that it's the idea that it believes that these hostages must be freed. There's no accept. We cannot continue about our daily routine with just accepting the idea that these hostages were going to be rotting in Gaza. We're going to get them out. But given the fact that the U.S. also has a role to play as superpower here, it was interesting to hear how they don't have an alternative if these talks don't go well, which is what's happening right now. Hamas doesn't seem to be particularly edgy to try to get a deal in the immediate term. They are very adamant about getting as many people back to northern Gaza with no unrestricted access, is how they're looking at it, which Israel is very much against. But the fact that the talks have gone on for so many months, I mean, we're in the 6 months into the war, and this is our only route to ending it, is how the U.S. sees it. I'm not going to judge whether that's wrong or right, but it's interesting to note that this is the only plan that they have, which is a hostage deal that gets you to end the war through subsequent negotiations and different phases of the deal, and then you have the Saudi normalization component and the Palestinian political horizon component and a new axis against Iran. But it all starts with a hostage deal, and if you don't get that first chip to fall, none of these other chips do. And that's a pretty bit, you're banking a lot of money on this one very difficult negotiation when you have to rely on someone like Yahya Sinwar.
We'll go to a show break and discuss this further.
I got married this Monday in the middle of a war.
You are not a soldier anymore. You are 50 years old. What is the matter with you?
It's like a couple of kilometers from here. Like, my friend has a 4x4. Let's just go cut across the fields and go get him.
Israel Stories, Wartime Diaries. Voices that try to capture slivers of life right now.
And he told me, take with you a sleeping bag and a tent and just go.
I texted him after I was told that he was killed.
From their eyes, I was a traitor.
Everybody needs their blankie, their teddy bear, something to make them feel safe.
I'm just another grandfather looking after his grandchild while his son is off at war.
These children of Hamas now will be the killer of my children.
I desperately wanted to talk about sex during my eulogy for Ido.
Everyone has to choose to be optimistic because we don't have room for pessimism.
Check out Israel Story wherever you get your podcasts.
And we're back. As you noted, Hamas refuses to back down from its demands for a full ceasefire, but has agreed to send a delegation for renewed talks to Cairo over the weekend. And at the same time, a senior Israeli official actually told you yesterday that the mediators of hostage negotiations between Israel and Hamas are really failing to exert any pressure on the terror group. I mean, the mediators, as I'm reading it, would be the U.S., as noted, and Qatar. Who else would they be talking about? But as we all see, the position of Hamas is unchanged for weeks, if not actually into the months now. So maybe that's actually an accurate assessment.
Yeah, this was a very senior official involved in this talks who spoke with me and said that he was classifying the mediators. He didn't get specific until he was only specific about Qatar, but the mediators are also the U.S. and they're also Egypt. And the fact that he kind of lumped them all together, said they're led by Qatar, and was that the idea that they could be, if they wanted to be exiling Hamas leaders that are currently in Qatar, they could be shuttering their bank accounts that are being used to fund what he said was terror, and they're not taking those steps. And the Israeli official is getting increasingly frustrated that this is how the negotiations are going, and they're letting Hamas drag its feet, that Sinwar doesn't really want a deal, that he's interested in more Palestinian suffering in Gaza, that he's interested in another escalation in Gaza, and is just kind of waiting it out. That was his approach, and he said that there, despite their reports that there had been some sort of rejection of an Israeli proposal, this Israeli official said, no, we haven't heard back from Hamas. It's just dragging its feet, and we need the mediators to do more. More to note that Biden on Friday, President Biden, penned letters, which is an interesting tactic. You can also pick up the phone, but I guess this is a more formal request that he's making to the leaders of Egypt and Sisi and the Sheikh Amir of the Emir of Qatar, basically asking them to pressure Hamas as well. I think so. The pressure, that request for pressure, is coming from both ends, both from Israel and the U.S., who both obviously want to see a deal as soon as possible, if possible. At least definitely the negotiators in Doha and Cairo, and also President himself. So we'll see if this extra pressure works. But again, the U.S. has no alternative if it doesn't.
It is verging on the theater of the absurd to many Israelis to note that Hamas, the murderous terror group that invaded Israel, slaughtered 1,200, took 253 hostages, is holding all the cards, and that Israel is being really reviled and denigrated on the international stage because Israel is being pressured to end the war. I find this very confusing, and I think many Israelis do as well. Do you have any insight into this diplomatic power balance?
Yeah, I think Israel might have been in a different place, at least with the U.S., because even with the U.S., we're seeing in recent days statements that kind of walk away from their initial position, which was that a ceasefire must be conditioned on a hostage deal. Depending on the day and the person you ask in the administration, which from my understanding, there's a bit of a fight in the administration right now of what the U.S. position should be, that I think they recognize that they don't have an alternative to a hostage deal, to a ceasefire other than a hostage deal, and that's why they're so adamant about trying to get one. On the other hand, because the humanitarian situation has gotten so bad, that they also just feel like the need to be at least be able to say, regardless of what happens, we just believe that there's a need for a ceasefire. And that's what came up during, according to an official I spoke with, during the call between Biden and Netanyahu, was that it was, he said, you should empower your negotiators more, but also we really need a pause right now because this strike on the World Central Kitchen convoy, it's caused that aid group and others to leave the strip, and now we have fewer people left to be able to distribute aid in a place where we don't really want UNRWA doing it. We don't obviously want Hamas doing it. The options are limited and we need time to regroup. And he just talked about a short pause, but it was not conditioned on a hostage release. And that's pretty noteworthy that Biden himself in a call with Netanyahu is separating too, and it's something that Israeli leaders definitely took note of and asked for clarifications afterwards. And then the White House did issue clarifications saying, you know, we do condition the ceasefire and hostage deal. But the more that the other officials don't, you can see that there's the separation because of the humanitarian situation. And I just note, I think that's kind of been the Achilles heel, this frustration that Israel is not doing enough on that front. And that's why they expect more of Israel. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said yesterday that Israel's not Hamas, that we hold them to higher, different standards, and they need to be able to treat, it's how you treat every single civilian, and given that each life lost is an entire world lost, and that's how we're looking at these civilian deaths. The fact that I think there was really a lot, I spoke weeks ago with a U.S. official about the possibility of Erez crossing open, and they said there's no chance Israel would agree to it. There's a lot of domestic politics, and we need this crossing open. We try to get aid into northern Gaza, but there's no way Israel will to agree to it. And there's this frustration that the only way that they can get Israel to act is basically by threatening, and that's what Biden did in this call he didn't say exactly what he would do, but he said that we won't be able to stick with you if this continues. We won't be able to support you. What that means, I don't know. I think Biden wouldn't totally abandon Israel, and he said that a few times. But again, this frustration is that this didn't have to get this bad in order for you guys to make this decision. We didn't have to have this major rift in order for these steps to be taken, which we believe in the end of the day, and this is what Jack Lew said as well, is that this is in your interest to improve the humanitarian situation in Gaza, because it gives you more time and more runway to prosecute this war. The less you do with this, the shorter the war will be, because we'll be pressured, the international community will pressure us to end this war. So I think if you see a calming of the humanitarian situation, which is by no means guaranteed, again, it's going to depend on the distribution of aid and who's going to come in instead of World Central Kitchen in the meantime, I do think you'll see more of the U.S. talking about its original talking points about how Hamas is the one that holds the cards, and Hamas could end this war immediately if it just threw down its weapons and released the hostages.
So words matter, obviously, and feelings matter, even on the diplomatic stage, as we're hearing. And two officials recently told you that Qatar passed on to Mossad chief David Barnea in a recent meeting that Doha is not really inclined to help out in the reconstruction of Gaza, given Israel's treatment of Qatar throughout the war. And this is a mighty blow, if true, because I think Israel is really counting on the friendly Arab neighborhood to build up the Gaza Strip again.
Yeah, definitely. I think there are some in Israel, though, that really would like to distance from Qatar. They don't trust Qatar as a state actor. They're concerned about its ties with Hamas and the funding that's been given, and this broader, I think it's part of a different axis of countries in the Arab world that are not Saudi Arabia and the UAE, which Israel has an easier time dealing with, these more secular-run governments, Egypt, Jordan. But they want to take a lot of other Israeli officials will say we need to take the help from wherever we're willing to get it. And if there's a country willing to help reconstruct Gaza, we want to be able to keep them on our side, because we're going to need, it's in our interest for the Strip to be stabilized after the war. Netanyahu himself has talked about Arab involvement in the security, the economy, and the civil affairs of Gaza after the war. But the Sheikh Mohammed, Prime Minister of Qatar, said basically we're not going to be interested in doing that unless it's part of a broader two-state solution initiative. We're not going to be, this is some falling in line with what we've heard from Emirati and Saudi and Egyptian and Jordanian officials who say, we don't want to just go in, rebuild homes only for them to be knocked down in the next door. So we want this to be the last time we're rebuilding these buildings. And the way to do that is to try to bring some sort of end to the conflict, obviously a lofty goal, but that's what they're saying is going to be their condition for involvement. But the other thing that Attani, I think, said that was separate from the complaints that you're, that the talking points that you hear from other Arab leaders is that there's this frustration in Doha with the treatment that Israel is with the Israel's treatment of Qatar throughout the war. Basically, there's several instances where Netanyahu over the recent days and weeks has talked about how Qatar, and last night we had senior Israeli official telling me that the Qatar is not pressuring Hamas enough, and that's really been a sticking point. Just think about like 2 months ago, or in October actually, the first month of the war, Tsahi Hanegbi, National Security Council chairman, tweeted his praise of Qatar. So we're at a totally different place now. I think it's, given that there hasn't been another deal, that's kind of been a point of contention. And now we're like, well, what's the point of Qatar if they can't bring home the goods, is the Israeli approach right now. And Qatar does not appreciate being just slammed in the media like that. There's other examples that Attani gave of Qatari funded hospitals or funded schools in Gaza that were hit. And there was an Israeli IDF claim that there was a Hamas tunnel underneath the Qatari funded hospital. Those were not taken very well, those claims, by Qatar, which issued condemnations. And then the official I spoke with said that the IDF privately expressed regret and said it was going to issue a public apology, but never did. So I think they're still sour about that. And then on Thursday, we had MSNBC interview where Nir Barkat, the economy minister, Likud minister, called Qatar an enemy state and funders of terror and wolves in sheepskin. So that didn't go too well in Qatar either, and they hit back. Their spokesman issued a long statement saying that this is just a populist politician that's engaging in what they call Qatar bashing as a means to improve his own political future, but he's neglecting the hostages, and that's what the focus should be on right now. So ties are not very good, I would say, between the two countries. It doesn't set the stage for Qatar to want to be involved afterwards. Some might say it's a good thing to distance itself from Qatar. Others would say this is problematic. We don't have so many people we can rely on. As for what Barnea responded, I think that's a bit of a point of contention. The Mossad chief, when he heard this, the Qataris tell me that Barnea was the one who asked for help in the revival of Gaza after the war. The Israelis tell me that's very much not what he said. Barnea is against post-war involvement of Qatar, but feel right now they just need to be kind of maintain a good relationship for these negotiations. And Barnea is the Israeli representative, so all the more so he does. So it's unclear what exactly led to this statement by Attani about putting his foot down, but definitely an interesting window into the deteriorating relationship between the two countries.
And finally, also in terms of diplomacy, the Palestinian Authority wants the United Nations Security Council to vote this month to make it a full member of the world body, which is a move that would, as I understand it, be a de facto declaration of statehood. So we've recently seen some surprises from the U.S., and there was, of course, talk through the New York Times columnist Thomas Friedman that this could be a real possibility that the U.S. would declare a Palestinian state. But what is actually the expected outcome of this vote later this month?
Yeah, we might not even have a vote because I don't think the U.S. right now is in a position where it wants to support U.N. membership, full state membership for the Palestinians. The feeling is that we should get to this process through a broader initiative that actually leads to them establishing a state. And if you do what you did many years ago, where the Palestinians got observer state status and they raised the flag at the UN and Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas tried to make a celebration out of it, nobody came because they knew that there was no implication from this move. And the US does not want to just see another repeat of that where that happens. They want this to actually have teeth and mean something, and just doing it unilaterally right now and without any context of what's going on in the world right now, which is we're nowhere near a Palestinian state, we're nowhere near negotiations to get to that end. This just becomes something that maybe might feel good for a minute, but doesn't actually improve the situation for Palestinians on the ground. The U.S. does not plan to support it, so either they'll have to feel isolated and feel be the only ones to block it, or they'll manage to convince other members to not bring this up for a vote.
Okay, Jacob, thank you so much for all of your updates and insights today.
Thanks for having me, Amanda. Shabbat shalom.
Shabbat shalom. Thanks for listening to the Times of Israel's Daily Briefing. Please check out another installment tomorrow. This episode was produced by the Podwaves. If you have any questions or comments about this or any other episode, please drop us an email to podcast@timesofisrael.com. Until tomorrow, shalom.